I am happy to welcome Matt Welch, the current editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, of the print edition of the magazine that I've been affiliated with for 15 years now, actually. Matt, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me here.
We will talk for about an hour, and the first third is going to be about the stories that we read. We looked at about six or eight of Matt's stories on topics ranging from baseball and the Cuban baseball league, to politics, to stories about John McCain, to Ralph Nader and alternative media. So let's begin. We're going to talk first about. I would like you guys to raise specific questions about specific stories, either what Matt was driving at with these stories, or where did he get the sources, or what's a larger context for that. Then we will have a section where we talk more broadly about how new media is changing the way that we discuss politics or conceive of politics, talk about culture and new media and the ways that they work either together or not. And then we'll follow with a kind of career pathway of how Matt ended up where he is. He has taken a very long route to Washington, D.C. He started out in Long Beach, California, spent time in L.A. and Santa Barbara, Europe, you know, various other places, and then eventually D.C. So let's have the first question. Who wants to ask the first question?
Okay. In your Woes Media article, you talk about some of the things that you disagreed with that very recognizable journalists and advocates are talking about. If you don't think that journalism students should look to them for advice, who would you recommend they do on becoming a journalist?
That's an interesting question. Practitioners, I think, primarily are always the more interesting people. When I started journalism, it was at my college newspaper, and we didn't have a single journalism class, but we had a daily newspaper that we had to get out every day. And what we did there, whether it's right or wrong, is that we just identified people that we looked up to and listened to what they said, both in terms of their own practitioning, if that's a word, and just try to be inspired from their example. For me, a big chunk of example was sort of the new journalism that came out of the 1960s. People like Hunter Thompson, Tom Wolfe, Norman Mailer when he was doing nonfiction. A lot of these people, not only did they write this really interesting and wonderful kind of a narrative-style journalism, but they talked about the process. I mean, they sort of opened up their homework. And for me, that was a really kind of revealing and interesting sort of moment you could sort of see how they did it. They dropped breadcrumbs. And so I always look towards them to be, at the beginning and just people who are actually in the game trying to do journalism first. But I wouldn't, you know, it's to each according to, you know, what works best inspirationally. But for me, I've never really understood what nourishment I can take from someone who studies journalism from an academic point of view, but who is not in the process of practicing it. That's my own bias for a lot of reasons. But
guys like William Kovach and Rosenstiel, they're journalists, right?
Or Kovach was for a long time. Rosenstiel pretty much has not been.
Uh-huh.
Robert Kaiser, who's a guy that I savage in that book and who interviewed me recently, he apparently forgot all about it. But he's been like the managing editor for the Washington Post for 30 years. But part of my overall critique, and I don't know if it comes in that piece so much, but even people who develop their theories about journalism from the seat of a dominant and sort of monopolistic media institution, of which local newspapers are probably the biggest example, your Washington Post, your LA Times, those people themselves, even though they are practitioners, mm-hmm. end up having a skewed vision because they are working in an essentially non-competitive sort of format, mm-hmm. and they think that their world that they operate in is the world that all journalism either is or should operate from, and I dispute that contention.
Hmm. Okay. Next question.
Okay, in your Be Afraid of President McCain article, you kind of, keep in mind this is over a year ago, and you kind of set up all the reasons why we should kind of fear McCain in office. I was just wondering if now it's getting closer to the election, over a year since you've written the article, if any of your opinions have changed about the candidate.
That's interesting. Since that article, I wrote a book on the same subject, and which came out in October of 2007, and the paperback version just came out, and I had to do a foreword of it. A lot of the kind of, you know, predictions that I was throwing out there sort of bizarrely came true. When I had to write the book, my due date was the week that his campaign was almost suspended, not because of a debate, but because it was going to hell in a handbasket back in July of 2007. And so I had to cast the intro as like, well, you know what? He works better as a counterpuncher. Just when you think that he's down and out, that's when he comes back and blah, blah, blah. My opinion on him has changed a little bit for the worse since then, just because of the normal conduct of the campaign. I think that he has ended up going in a sort of more, a less honorable, sort of less high-minded campaign than I expected from him.
What do you mean by that? That he's running a negative campaign?
Yeah, or? I mean, I expect everyone to run a negative campaign at all times, but I actually expected these two candidates, because they are always going on very high-minded themes, to sort of raise their games a little bit more. And he has really, in the last month or 2 months, run and hid from the media, which used to be his base, but now it no longer is. And just the campaign itself, he's just he's kind of flapping back and forth and doing one stunt after another, and not sort of clearing out a kind of a philosophical ground that would be of interest. But part of it's just that I disagree with what he says.
Now, your kind of growing dislike of McCain has not necessarily meant that you're more favorable towards Obama, or does it? Or
No, I'm less favorable towards Obama. Yeah. I mean, than I was, let's say. I had hopes for Obama. My big policy as a voter is foreign policy. That's what I care about the most, and that's what I think is sort of most screwed up currently and is most potentially dangerous going forward. I don't pretend like that my position is the right one. It's just the one I personally think. I thought for a while Obama had an interesting foreign policy critique, saying that not only do we have to change policy, we have to change the mindset that led to the policy. That sounded interesting to me. I don't think, after having reported a little bit and gone to the Democratic convention, I don't see much evidence for any kind of changed mindset in his foreign policy. And in the meantime, I find his economics to be much less palatable than Bill Clinton's or John Kerry's or even Howard Dean's.
Now, you went to both the Republican and Democratic National Conventions for Reason. But you also covered Ralph Nader's campaign in 2000 when he was a serious player. What was it like covering a third-party candidate?
It was great. It was so much fun. I mean, people forget now, but Nader was selling out arenas. He sold out Madison Square Garden, charging tickets for $15 a head in 2000. And he was getting, you know, Eddie Vedder opening for him, and Tom Tomorrow, the cartoonist who does This Modern World, and Patti Smith and her band, and Michelle Schacht. I saw her in Long Beach.
There you go.
Anyways, it was this sort of like carnival alternative atmosphere, mostly of disaffected lefties, the old sort of progressive left who felt like they'd been shut out of the Clinton years. But also it was an opportunity to hear things that you wouldn't hear otherwise about the drug war, about a lot of the things that we care about non-interventionism, and not that I necessarily agreed with their cast on it. But it's always sort of invigorating to see a third party, from my weird point of view at least, a third party kind of move or movements of people that feels like they have the wind at their backs.
Right.
Now, obviously, that changed the morning after the election when it looked like Nader probably threw the vote in some respects in Florida and became a pariah. And a lot of the reasons that he stated for running for president, he never followed up on. Like, he was there to build a big Green Party movement, and he ended up not caring at all about that. But it was a hoot to cover. A strange thing about it, I was working then for a website for a lefty phone company called Working for Change, or Working Assets. The website was called Working for Change. We were the only news organization covering Nader full time.
Really?
AP was not, Reuters was not, UPI was not, and no major newspaper was. Nader got 2.7% of the vote and probably would have had 4% if Gore had a more commanding lead, because people would have felt more comfortable voting for him. And no one covered him, even though we have 5 trillion political journalists in this country. It was a real eye-opener about like priorities and the built-in bias against third parties.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that we were talking about earlier about fragmentation, market fragmentation, audience fragmentation, one place where that really hasn't happened at all, and for reasons that Matt and I have discussed quite a bit in print, in politics, you don't see that. The Republicans and Democrats still have reliably 95% plus of the political market. But what's the next question? Yes, Cassie.
Well, going off of that comment, do you think that that will ever change? I mean, our system's kind of set up to be a two-party system. It's really hard to break those barriers. Do you see in the future of our country that the political journalists will be more fragmented and there will be more fragmentation?
I am an internal optimist about America and about the media and even about politics, despite all the evidence to the contrary every day. And so I think even though there is this really sort of entrenched, even rigged system, and importantly, you know, the two major parties have a guaranteed stream of income. Nick and I, again, we talk about this a lot. Your record companies, your newspapers, every sort of lumbering industry, airlines, car dealerships, whatever, or car makers, they're all getting hammered by the internet, by the proliferation of change and new entrants and all this kind of stuff. Democrats and Republicans, they're having the same thing happen. They're losing market share by a lot. I mean, the number of people who describe themselves as Republican is way down. The number of people who describe themselves as Democrat, especially compared to 1970, is way down. But they have a guaranteed income stream, unlike airlines, which is tax revenue. So it'll take the longest. This will be like the one area that'll take the longest. But when it happens, I think it'll be sort of it'll be quick and huge. That's just my feeling. As for political journalism, I think we've already seen a great fragmentation of it. I mean, it's no accident that I was, you know, covering Ralph Nader for a phone company. Think about that. That's crazy talk. And now there's such a huge proliferation of nonprofits, of just collections of people's of blogs, of blogs that are professional or group blogs and these kind of things, and just new venues out there everywhere. I think that we're seeing a huge proliferation, and it's really impacted the overall coverage, I think, hopefully for the better.
Next question.
Hi, so I eventually want to ask you something about the Cuban base. While on the topic of foreign policy and this McCain article, if you were given the opportunity to write an article that would be something like, be afraid of vice president and possible president if John McCain kicks it during his term, Palin, would you enjoy writing this piece and what would you focus on?
Would I enjoy writing it? I of course, I would love writing it. It'd be very fun. I should mention my sort of the genesis of the piece, because it wasn't like I sat down one day and said, you know, who's running for president? I think I'll go after that guy. It actually was kind of the opposite. I was going on a vacation in Mexico, like for the first time in 10 years, I took a vacation. And I took as reading material McCain's first two books, his sort of memoirs. And because I liked him, I would have voted for him in 2000 if I was given the opportunity. I ended up voting for Ralph Nader like an idiot, even though I covered him and grew to dislike a whole bunch of things that he was saying. So I found McCain to be an endearing kind of character. I'm like, hey, I don't understand this guy. I'll take his books to the beach while I'm sipping margaritas. And I did. And when reading this, these books, I was struck by a number of things, but one of which was all this sort of weird language that reminded me so much of 12-step programs and 12-step things. I didn't know what to, I mean, and it's on every page. It really jumped out at me. And don't ask me why I know 12-step language. So I did not know what to do with this information. I remember talking about it with Nick. Like, I can't figure out what that could possibly mean. And it took a while of sorting through it that I kind of developed what at first I thought was sort of a crackpot theory about the way McCain thinks about the world. It seems to have kind of synthesized. So it wasn't like, hey, let's go after this guy. It's actually like, I'm genuinely interested as a person and as a journalist in this character, and I want to try to figure him out. Palin, you know, I don't have that great sense of. I think she's a fascinating American character and a persona, and I'm really glad that that she's on the ticket on some level. I don't think that she would be a good president. I think that the choice of it is on one level not serious, especially with McCain's given interest in foreign policy. But as a character, I think she's great. My wife, I should mention, is describing herself these days as a Palinista. So, you know, I can only dislike Sarah so much without getting in trouble. But if I went after her, you'd just have to go to Alaska. And that'd be the best part of all, of getting to see a state that I know nothing about and have never visited. And, you know, it would be interesting. I'm, for instance, attracted as a personal college dropout myself in the fact that she went to like 5 colleges in 6 years or 6 colleges in 5 years, this kind of stuff. My mom tried to like send me an email like, isn't this proof that she's unqualified? You know, and I'm like, hey, mom, do you remember who your son is here? But I'm kind of interested in her path, how she's a self-made woman. You know, she's not, unlike John McCain, unlike a lot of people, she wasn't born into a path towards success. She kind of cobbled it together herself in a very interesting way. And so I would probably focus as much about her character and persona than as, you know, what she might end up being like as a president, I'm guessing.
This is a conversation I've had with a lot of people. There's obviously Palin on a certain level is completely unprepared for the job. And on another level, why do we take her so much less seriously than somebody like Joe Biden, who has a demonstrated, you know, capability of making totally boneheaded decisions as well as gaffes, and, you know, is a plagiarist, is a fraud in various ways. What does that work there?
I think part of it, an important part of it, is that Palin was unknown. So that's just chum in the water for sharks or for barracudas or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you want to figure out who this person is, especially when she became a force of nature. I mean, she gave a speech in Florida and like 50,000, 60,000 people showed up. She's clearly connecting on some level. When I was at the Republican convention, it was electrifying in the room. And that convention was the opposite of electrifying. It was it was dead. People are so bored of Republicanism after 8 years of it in the White House. But as soon as she was mentioned or talked, the room lit up. So there's something interesting about that requires the extra attention. But I think also it is that your average political journalist is not as, let's say, sensitive to the excesses of Joe Biden as the average Reason magazine journalist. He's particularly horrible about the drug war, but mainstream journalism does not punish people who were horrible on the drug war ever, for example.
Yeah. Next question.
Clarify for me. What do you mean horrible on the drug war?
Joe Biden, where dost thou begin? He introduced the RAVE Act, was that a year and a half ago, 2 years ago?
More than that.
But more than that, which would, I think, prosecute or have a terrific liability for anyone who owned a club where drugs might ever be taken. That kind of thing. He was one of the first co-sponsors, I think, after Len Bias died. This is before you people were born. In the late 80s, a Celtics basketball player who...
Maryland. He was drafted number one by the Celtics.
Yeah.
Have you guys heard of Len Bias? It's his story. He was a really good college basketball player at Maryland, and then he died after doing cocaine, and that ushered in a huge wave of prohibitionist talk about how addictive cocaine was and how dangerous, et cetera, and a real ratcheting up of prohibition against drugs. And Joe Biden was one of the frontline speakers.
Yeah, and that's where the disparities that you've probably heard of in sentencing between crack cocaine and powder cocaine were a result of. Basically, at the time, Joe Biden and others said, you know, crack, it's terrible. It's ruining our minority communities. We have to just put everyone in jail forever on drugs. And he has a long history on this that I'm sure Nick would be happy to share with you, which is my filibuster can't cite chapter and verse.
Okay.
But it's long. It's never ending. He's never come back from any of it, and it's never really challenged on any of it.
Next, let's have one more question about the specific stories before we start talking about media more generally.
I only mean this in the best of ways because I love him dearly. When I was reading your article, it reminded me a lot of Rick Riley, and I don't know if it's just like the narrative aspect of kind of an off the beaten path story, or, you know, a little known athlete that did something amazing on the off field. But do you feel like that has any of like the tone or style of Rick Riley? And also maybe who are some of your other sport writer influences?
It's a good question. I grew up, as a lot of people my age did, reading Sports Illustrated just religiously. I don't recall attaching myself to various writers of Sports Illustrated, whether it's Rick Riley or Frank DeFord. I know I've read thousands of their articles, so there's no way that they didn't have a foundational impact on my brain. My primary source of sort of a sports journalism influence is Bill James, the sort of sabermetric writer who now works for the Boston Red Sox, but has written all these sort of abstract things. It's more, you know, analysis and research and things. One of my influences is a guy I grew up with on the same block, a guy named Eric Neal, who writes for ESPN.com. In fact, he probably got me that story since he had just worked there. He does this sort of literary journalism. And a lot of the new journalism of which I was speaking before, a lot of it was this sort of great narrative, and again, off the beaten path in many cases, stories about kind of people you wouldn't ever really think to focus on. For me, I came at this with just sort of a love and interest in Cuban baseball. I went to Cuba, tried to move there and lived there for a short while at least, and was fascinated about their baseball culture. And in the process of going to Cuba in 1998, I discovered that there was this whole, the Washington Senators in the 50s, who were terrible. What was the phrase they said about them?
They were first, it was Washington first in war, first in peace, and last in the American
League. American East, least, yeah. But they were filled with Cubans, and they're mm-hmm. all, and the Cubans were at that time in baseball, which was pretty white bread, you know, a bunch of damn Italians were running the show in the 50s. Suddenly they injected a bunch of Cubans with high leg kicks, and who were like practicing judo and just being very colorful characters. And I just found that out in that process and wanted to write about one of them, and just got his phone number basically, and decided to let him tell the story. But I love that kind of journalism of just sort of focusing on a backup left fielder from, 1959 or something like that. It's great fun.
Mary, did you have a question? Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more broadly about media and the way that new media is changing the way journalism gets done, the way politics get done, the way culture gets done. You have an interesting career in that you worked at a college daily for a while, then you worked at the printing company that made the college paper. You did a lot of alternative things. You started an English language paper in Prague in the Czech Republic in the early 90s. Then you kicked around in various places like Working for Change. You worked at Reason for a while, which is part of the alternative media, and then went to the LA Times and are back at Reason. So it's an interesting loop. Are there questions about the kind of general mediascape that you want to ask?
Well, I wanted to ask whether there, right now, there are any currently updated blogs that you think consistently do journalism better than more mainstream newspapers that you read on a daily basis or anything like that?
Generally speaking, the answer is no. There are some. I don't know what their names are. My blog reading habits are so stuck in 2002, it's almost embarrassing. You guys, I think, have the Columbia Journalism Review piece that I wrote. And I was sort of a minor player in this post September 11th explosion of blogs that happened. And I was a fanatical blog reader. Every day I read 100 blogs. Every day now, how many blogs do you read every day? Five, maybe?
Yeah.
It's kind of like that with me. I would say it's less about individual blogs. I mean, you find, I guess, the TPM Muckraker does an amount of journalism where they mm-hmm. throw like some original reporting out there. But it's more that you see collections of people doing local journalism here and there, whether like let's just cover City Hall in Lakewood, California, because there's no newspaper doing it. I would say that's more than your average. That's more interesting than your average political blog just yapping about McCain and Obama. And I think that's where the future of this stuff is going to go a lot more than just this sort of commentary loop that we've all been in. But let's not discount the paper. I love to talk trash about them. I worked at the LA Times for 2 years, which is about long enough to build up a lifetime of hatred towards these kind of media institutions. But on a daily basis, that, especially if you compare it to newspapers in Europe, for crying out loud, these things are just thick with information. It's not necessarily very interesting. They don't show a whole bunch of life. The people who work there are boring, you know, whiners in large respect. But it's still overall quality, thickness, and all this kind of stuff is pretty high, and it's going to take a long time for blogs to match that. But I don't think that's where blogs will go. Blogs will go and they'll hive off little bits of specialty, little areas that they can do, that single proprietor can do, that other people can't. And that's the future of that more than replicating the newspaper model.
What is it about large newspaper institutions or large media institutions where they begin to become stultified or ossified? I mean, does it have to be that way? Or were there parts of the LA Times, which does have a virtually complete monopoly on its media market, are there parts of it that were really lively and exciting? Or
there were just a couple of little parts, and they usually would be snuffed out bureaucratically, mm-hmm. seriously, within a year or two of experimentation.
Is that because they don't feel a need to? I mean, they're not hungry, or is no, it that a, is there groupthink? Or
my analysis after having been there, especially, is that these organizations become so conservative, not politically, mm-hmm. but they're hidebound. They can't change. Right at the LA Times, right now, you have an owner who wants to change it root and branch and make mm-hmm. it a website that publishes a newspaper. Mm-hmm. You have employees who want to do that. You have an editor-in-chief who wants to do that. Everybody wants to do that, but they can't because they have an organization with a culture that is so overwhelming and so ossified that it can't change. I've become very pessimistic about that. I went into the Times being very optimistic about it. Like, I'm going to help them change and try to just sort of storm the ramparts and shake things up. My general take on what happened to newspapers is that from the beginning of newspapers in the United States up until around 1960, they were among the most competitive, the most wild, the most interesting sectors in the world. Every city had multiple newspapers. They had a Democrat newspaper, a Republican newspaper, maybe a labor newspaper, maybe a business newspaper, a mm-hmm. French language newspaper, all these kind of things. Starting after the war, and especially from about 1960 on, cities boiled down from 7 newspapers to 1 in a hurry. And that one newspaper that would survive ended up being one who did 2 things. One got totally fat of mm-hmm. printing a monopoly newspaper, and they all chose this sort of high-minded objectivity. Because objectivity in newspaper journalism was not invented by the journalists. It was invented by the advertisers. Because advertisers wanted to be able to have one newspaper, not just the Democrat, not just the Republican. Let's have one that can not offend any part of the readership, and we'll do it by being objective. So it was sort of a bargain, maybe a devil's bargain, or maybe a good bargain that newspaper employees, journalists, made with the business side. Okay, you'll become a monopoly, but enshrine our values. And it was a very happy collision there for about 2 decades until the introduction of desktop publishing in the 1980s, mm-hmm. I think, was the first big thing, which is where you saw the rise of all these like business journals that you see in almost every city of any size. A lot of newsletters started publishing overnight. When I was working at the college paper, I was doing typesetting and production, which we ran this whole Unisetter. This is all like old war stories. But point being is that my first year of doing that, we were all on Unisetter and film and wax mm-hmm. and paper and on all this old technology. The next year, we went to a laser printer, mm-hmm. which changed everything. It suddenly you could design the paper using a Macintosh program, and boom, it was cheap. And from that point on, people could go out and start their own damn newspapers, which is what we did in Czechoslovakia. And now the internet and some other technologies that have come online can bite off chunks of that, but the mindset that grew in those fat years from 1960 to, let's say, 1989 even, is one that it cannot easily be dislodged. Journalists just hold on to all the values. Many of them are great values, don't get me wrong. But they are so reluctant to change because of them. And so it's I think that they've just basically become the equivalent of, you know, Central European post offices or banks or something like that. They hate their customers. They're way overstaffed even now. And it's not the place that you're going to go looking for innovation.
Next question about media, new forms of media.
You were talking about how when you went to the newspaper, you were going to try to change things. What were you going to try to change about it to make it more innovative?
You know, basically I was trying to yank. I was at the opinion section of the LA Times. I was trying to yank the paper into at least the late 20th century, doing such crazy stuff as printing the extra letters that we received, the ones that we didn't have room to print. Let's print those online. It took me 2 years. I wasn't able to do that.
What was the objection to doing that?
There was never an objection. It was because you had to get buy-in from the library, which deals with NexisLexis. You had to get buy-in from the letters editor over here, and then also the website director, and then also Chicago. It was just a bureaucratic nightmare because they had a bureaucracy that could spin nightmares. So, I mean, I introduced a blog. I introduced sort of live chats with editors. I said, hey, let's put up a mission statement of our editorial beliefs. I tried very hard. I did not win on a lot of things, but including, let's talk about our composition of the editorial board, put up pictures and resumes, and say who they vote for and if they belong to political parties. That last bit was a bridge too far for them. It's something that we do at Reason and we'll be doing again.
What was the argument against that, particularly at an opinion page?
Because people will use it against us. Newspapers are cultures are so defensive, you wouldn't believe it. Like the internal email, if I showed it to outsiders, they still wouldn't believe it. These people who make a ton of money, I mean just a lot of money even now, they sit around and are so in a defensive crouch. They will email each other like, you know what, no matter what people say, we're the best newspaper in the world, and we today our front page made me proud to be an American. And it's like, you know, if you just say, hey, you know what, your stuff today was mediocre, which is the values that I learned in college when we had to police ourselves. If you say that to a colleague at the LA Times, they'll just sort of step back like, oh, you're a different one. And chances are you won't live there long. And it's bizarre to me. It's just really hyper-defensive, hating on the readers. So it was just a bunch of mild steps like this of more openness, more transparency, more sense of stare decisis in our editorial news making and judgment. And with a few exceptions, a lot of the things that I tried to and succeeded at introducing ended up going away. Some of them remain.
What was the goal by introducing a blog at the opinion page? What were you hoping to accomplish?
I wanted to build the sense that, because Los Angeles is a very interesting city on a number of reasons, but it's interesting for blogging and opinion journalism. I wanted to get the LA Times opinion page in the game. You know, I want it to be a central place where people would go and expect to be able to comment on all the stuff that they read in the newspaper and didn't like, and also sort of interact, you know, with Mickey Kouse over here or Eugene Volokh over here or people who live in L.A. and are part of this group. And it was also my kind of backwards way or backhanded way to get some of those people especially into the conversation because for whatever reason they weren't all that wanted on the printed page itself. So it was kind of like, let's start a alternative newspaper within the newspaper online and just sort of spread it out. And a huge part of it was to, I mean, L.A. suffers, especially the L.A. Times has a weird history with its city that it's in. And part of it is it's literally a barricade against the citizens of the city. There's a big bombing case there in the teens. It's fascinating. But to break that down, to break down this huge, like, colossal person sitting on a hill and you, the little person, let's just have conversations. That way you can begin to like restore faith with readers. That was what I saw as the biggest reason to have a blog and to have like constant interactivity with people. Just like, let's humanize this instead of you just throwing, you know, email or hate mail and never expecting a response. Let's have a conversation.
Well, let's. We've got about 15 minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about career arcs and trajectories. One of the interesting things, I think, about Matt's career, but most careers in general, is that they often take very odd twists and turns that are difficult to predict or foresee. Can you give us a quick, the 30-second thumbnail of your professional life?
college dropouts, worked at a great college daily newspaper, was trying to figure out, and I in the last 2 years I worked there in a professional capacity, employed by the university because I had a very complicated job. So I actually made some cash. And so at the time that I would have graduated in June 1990 was the end of my tenure there. And so I tried to figure out what am I going to do with my life. And I set aside the Christmas break of 1989 as the time to figure that out. That coincided in Christmas of 1989 with a bunch of things, not least of which is the collapse of communism as we know it, and a bunch of like playwrights and students storming the walls of various castles. And so that seemed like a much more attractive option than like going back to community college or you know working as a paste-up guy on some alternative weekly. So one-way ticket to midnight, one-way ticket to Europe. And ended up in Prague and with no real ideas, and then saw that there wasn't a...
Why did you go to Prague as opposed to someplace else?
More beautiful, wanted to hang out with student revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. Students played a huge role in that revolution, and so they're like my age. I wanted to hang out, see how they were so different. Mm-hmm. Totally cheap beer and delicious, and there was just... The spirit in Prague in 1990 is something that I just can't even really communicate, of two whole sides of a long Cold War, basically. And this sounds cheesy, but like waking up one day and saying, hey, you know, this isn't just a dark spot on a map. This is a human being who likes the Velvet Underground as much as I do. And that collision was exhilarating to be part of. Just so happened that a bunch of my friends from the college paper happened to be traveling through. We decided to start a paper that lasted 5 years. Went to Budapest, worked at a Budapest Business Journal for 3 years. Tried to move to Cuba, as I said before. That failed.
What was the appeal of Cuba?
I wanted to see communism before it collapses, mm-hmm. not just after. Mm-hmm. And thinking that I had recognized some traits that would happen and would have an insight that would be useful, mm-hmm. plus baseball, better weather, and mm-hmm. Better music.
Right.
People in Central Europe are really grumpy. I was tired of that. And so when that failed, went to L.A., became a freelancer, and I'm terrible at being a freelancer. I ended up getting involved with a former mayor of Los Angeles who wanted to start a newspaper. That almost happened, didn't quite. I wrote for the Online Journalism Review, this workingforchange.com thing, writing about Ralph Nader, started freelancing for Reason. After September 11th, started a weblog that became kind of popular for a short while. That, and it brought me a lot of new work. I became a columnist for the National Post because of that.
Which is a Canadian newspaper.
That used to be pretty good. And then, Reason changed my life, mm-hmm. And then LA Times, and then here. So pretty normal.
I'd like to know what's different about working at Reason than all the other the papers or publications you've been a part of.
There's a lot of commonalities with Reason and, let's say, the publications I worked at in Eastern Europe, just in terms of size. Size is a huge difference and determinant in any organization. When you have a newsroom of 10 people, which is roughly what we have here, the difference between that and a newsroom of 30 or a newsroom of 600 or 800 at the LA Times is just phenomenal. So on a really kind of core, stupid level, that's a big commonality. Reason has much more of a political profile. This is the first place and only place, I think, besides the Working for Change thing, that I worked with, there was sort of a specific ideological slant or interest, which for me actually traditionally has been uncomfortable. I don't like to have my politics defined either by friend or enemy. And when Nick first actually hired me for this job, he said, hey, I have to ask you to define your politics, and I refused to describe myself as libertarian. So there's some lesson for somebody out there.
I'm not sure
what
it is. I think
it
might be for me.
Yeah, mostly. Yeah. So in that sense, it's different. And also, I mean, compared to the places that I worked at in Eastern Europe and the LA Times, you have the sense of Reason that you're part of a national conversation. And I'll repeat a bit of that. Compared to working at the LA Times, you feel like at Reason you're part of a national conversation about politics and culture. That sounds bizarre, but the truth is, with rare exceptions, and maybe those exceptions are the Washington Post and the New York Times editorial pages and opinion pages, working at a big paper's like editorial and op-ed page, you're like not having much of an impact, most likely. And that's shocking to find out. And you don't have an organized sense of like getting into the ring and throwing punches. We do. And so it's very nice.
And so that you understand where he's coming from, the Los Angeles Times is what, like the third or fourth largest circulation daily
it's
in
fifth
the country?
And sinking okay. with a bullet, but okay. It's still really huge. But, you know, I will get more response by appearing for 5 minutes on Rachel Maddow's show than I will of writing the best piece of prose in the LA Times opinion section, and it's not even close.
You know, what has changed? Your career started when? Like, when did you become somebody who lived by whatever you made as a journalist?
What year? 1989.
Okay. And, I mean, what has been the single biggest change in terms of the kind of overall media scape, would you say, in the past, however, you know, almost 20 years? So.
Without question, the internet in two or three ways. One, and this will be lost on you guys probably, but the fact that you can just look anything up at any given time.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I was living in Bratislava. Actually, I was living in the Pravda building of Bratislava in 1992 in a room about the size of that chair. And like to find out to confirm any information in that setting was just not very easy. Mm-hmm. And now to be able to do that, I think we still haven't grasped that on mm-hmm. some level. Mm-hmm. In a very important way for me, it stopped there was basically only one career path or two career paths in journalism when I was coming out of school. You had to work your way up through a series of local dailies, each one larger and larger mm-hmm. in circulation, and that was the only way that anyone was ever going to talk to you. And you probably should come from a journalism school, get your two internships, mm-hmm. have a good GPA and all this kind of stuff, and maybe then they would talk to you. That just isn't the case anymore. It was still largely the case when I came back in 1998 from Europe. I came back, and my clips were not unreadable. They were halfway decent, at least. I had worked for United Press International, which people then still had heard of. But I didn't go there working for, you know, the Bakersfield Californian or something. Mm-hmm. And I literally had people say, like at the San Francisco Examiner, which a paper that was as lousy then as any paper has ever been, say, come back to me, kid, when you get some real clips. The Long Beach mm-hmm. Independent Press Telegrams, like, you know, come back to me when you've done some community journalism.
Right.
There is one path. I wasn't on that path. I was seen as kind of strange. In fact, the LA Times back then, I applied for a job with them. And the hiring editor literally said, and this is almost a direct quote, you know, you don't really fit into those little boxes that we like to have for people. It's kind of the point. Mm. And it was impressive to almost nobody that I had started a newspaper when I was 22 years old, which was the first, you know, post-communist newspaper in post-communist Europe. The one exception was a place called the Investor's Business Daily, which is sort of a cheapjack Wall Street journal for the West Coast. And they agreed to hire me until they found out that I didn't have a college degree. And they're like, sorry, man, rules are rules. So back then, you had to have that path. The internet has blown that path up. Hmm. It still exists, you know, in certain right. ways. But it has widened the options, and I think that's only to the good. It's created a meritocracy outside of the normal, really strict and kind of conservative strictures of how you can work.
Advice that you give to someone trying to make a career in journalism, because that trajectory doesn't really exist anymore?
That trajectory can still exist. What I'm saying is that there's more than one trajectory. That's exciting. So my advice is to read a lot and write. I mean, each of you have some weird specialty that you can seriously geek out on that you know a little bit better than probably anybody in the world. Write about that. Just start a blog, write about that, regardless of whether you plan on writing about it professionally or as a journalist. It's always good to practice and just do. Write headlines, write things, get stuff up out there. Do that, and then just read people, whether they're online or in book form, whether they're contemporary, whether they're 100 years old. Read people who you find inspiring in any way, shape, or form, and try to figure out how they did it, and ape them to whatever degree, mostly in the actual creation of your journalism more than the actual sort of trajectory of your career path necessarily, but you know, by going after the masters and trying to, it's like, you know, playing guitar, like figure out how to how that dude played that solo. That's a start of figuring out where you're going to go. I mean, there's a great story about Hunter Thompson, who's a big hero of mine, who would sit around and he retyped, you know, I think For Whom the Bell Tolls by Ernest Hemingway, just to get the rhythm and the feel of the language, which sounds bizarre, but it's, I think...
Sounds made up.
Sounds too. Totally yeah. made up, yeah. But it's kind of interesting. I wouldn't really go to that extent, but just read people who are great and you know, talk to them. That's also a weirdly interesting thing to do is you'd be surprised. It's a lonely profession on some level, and, you know, when you... just bum rush somebody who you are fond of, they will probably be flattered and be happy to give you better advice than I can.
Well, thank you very much. Sorry, I know you have a 5:30 interview.
I have a 5:30 flight.
Okay.
That's great. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Thanks. Okay.